From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made with a tweet. On April 14th, popular Christian author Rachel Held Evans tweeted, quote, "If you're the praying type, I'm in the hospital with the flu and UTI combo and a severe allergic reaction to the antibiotics they gave me, and I'm totally going to miss Game of Thrones," end quote. Now, despite the cheekiness, the situation was dire. After posting that tweet, Rachel Held Evans was placed in a medically induced coma because her brain suffered constant seizures. And then, when being weaned off the coma, her husband updated her followers with news that she had experienced extensive brain swelling. Rachel Held Evans died on May 4th at the age of just 37. A progressive Episcopalian, Evans gained a massive following for her writing that challenged the evangelical establishment. The Washington Post once called her the most polarizing woman in evangelicalism. Born in Alabama and growing up in Tennessee, she was raised in the evangelical church. In 2014, she announced she was leaving evangelicalism, saying she was exhausted by, quote, "wearing out my voice in calling for an end to evangelicalism's culture wars," end quote. And while she challenged the views of that church on the subjects of racism, abortion, LGBTQ rights, and the role of women, she continued to have a following among evangelicals. Some had left the church or lost their faith, but others still felt connected to their faith and were asking questions. Evans wrote about how she struggled with her own doubt and love for the church in her book, Inspired, Slaying Giants, Walking on Water, and Loving the Bible Again. She said, quote, "Anyone who has loved the Bible as much as I have and who has lost it and found it again knows how a relationship with the Bible can be as real and as complicated as a relationship with a family member or a close friend," end quote. She became a popular voice for Christians who did not want to leave their faith, but openly question parts of it. And that's the theme this hour, the practice and the impact of questioning, of doubting, of challenging the church at times, while seeking to apply values across society. Our guests are joining us to share their thoughts, not only on Rachel Held Evans, but their own journey and how they have kind of taken to those questions, how comfortable they are, or not at times. I mean, it's at different levels of all this stuff as we talk about doubting what we believe and what are our values. So it's a lot to talk about this hour. And Pastor Matthew Martin Nikoloff has helped put this conversation together, the pastor of the South Wedge Mission. Thanks for being back here, Pastor. Nice to have you.
Thank you for making this possible.
And also with us, Anna Voss is here. Anna is the owner and artist at Owl Post Lettering. Anna, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Shawnee Wilson is a PA for internal medicine at Trillium Health and co-chair of the President's Council of Diversity at Trillium Health. Shawnee, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for letting me come.
And Dr. Soon Il-sung is a primary care physician and chief of family medicine at Jordan Health. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks. Good to be here.
I want to listen first to the words of Rachel Held Evans, because for some of our listeners, it's been a hard month. I mean, taking in this news of the passing of Rachel Held Evans at the age of only 37 in a shock development has been rough. But if you don't know her, I think it'd be valuable to listen to some of her words here. This was a conversation she had on PBS, and she was having a conversation about her own sort of journey of doubt and faith and all of the things that kind of that come with that when you grow up in a community that's pretty tight-knit, pretty evangelical, and was wondering why you were kind of stepping out a little bit. So here's how she described that journey on PBS.
I had friends who, you know, kind of moved away from me when they saw what was happening, and I'm on prayer request lists for churches I don't even go to. So it's, you know, in a small town, if you start writing a blog about how you're not sure you believe what you used to believe about faith and about politics, it's going to start a little bit of gossip and conversation, and I still have to deal with that. But part of it was too, and this is something I kind of learned the hard way, when you're experiencing that kind of profound religious doubt, and when your faith and your religion is such a part of your community and the people you love and the people you spend your weekends with, when you start to doubt, you are so lonely in that journey, you kind of just want to drag everybody with you. So in a lot of ways, I started to approach my doubt the way I had once approached my faith, which was evangelistically. You know, I wanted to force everybody to ask the same questions I was asking. So it's like, I can see where that would have alienated some of my friends who would just like to go to dinner and a movie without like a side of existential crisis.
That's Rachel Held Evans on PBS. And you might have heard NPR in the last few weeks have played some of her other remarks in various settings. She wrote a number of books, and was a consistent writer and voice. So that's just a taste of how she described her own journey. And I'll start with Shawnee Wilson. As you think not only about Rachel Held Evans, but sort of your own path, what strikes you first?
I think the thing about Rachel that in my own journey that really struck me the most was just about the isolation and loneliness that occurs when you're actually going through this journey of questioning your faith and actually trying to reinvent faith. One of the things that folks that are dealing with their questioning of evangelicalism is the deconstruction of it and dealing with the reconstruction. And so she really gave a voice to those that are going through that journey, because she's right. I mean, it's isolation. It's a lot of loneliness. You don't know what to do. And really, you've been taught the opposite, that there is no questioning, you know, or that with questionings, there's always going to be some sort of answer, but there really is no in between. And so the gray area that I was speaking to you about before we came on the air is something that, you know, it's hard to put a face and a name to it. It's formless. It doesn't have any, it's not really something solid. So that's I think the thing that really strikes me about that is just, you know, reading her books and just hearing her talk is just, you know, like hearing somebody else's journey too is just really just resonates with me, and just kind of like it was nice to have somebody share that with me.
When you talk about the gray area, mm-hmm. is it uncomfortable at first? Is it always uncomfortable? Does it become more comfortable with time?
I don't know. I mean, it depends on who you ask. I can certainly, you know, the other people that I'm with here today, our co-answers. So one of the things I think, like, I don't know if it ever gets comfortable, because I don't think you ever really, you've been taught so long that everything's supposed to be a certain way, that when you actually start questioning, It's like your whole spiritual life is like gone on alert, you know, because remember, like in evangelicalism, it's like we are supposed, our primary goal as you being evangelical is that we are putting alarm systems in place to preserve your salvation. And so anything that will put that into jeopardy is automatically there's a super alarm on it. So it's like you're literally walking past those alarms to get to something else. It's disconcerting. It's destructive. You know, it puts people into a state of depression. And so there really is no comfort with it, I think. And I think that's part of the journey, and part of her journey was that there were certain things that she was going to have to reconcile. And it was really difficult, but she did it. But she was still questioning, still asking answers, like still trying to get uncomfortable in that space.
To be fair, before I turn to the other guests, when you say, you know, it can put people in a state of depression, I think what I'm hearing you say is for evangelicals who start to not walk past those alarm bells, because I have no doubt there are a number of very happy evangelicals.
Oh, of course.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like when you start to kind of turn the lights on and see what you've tried to train yourself not to see. Is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think. Okay. But I think the thing is like the action of it. So it's like, for instance, if you're walking past this alarm, I just want you to visualize with me that it's really like you're walking past something, but you're always looking backward, right? And that's that state of stress, that state of like, and that's what I'm saying. Like there's a constant stress that's actually just going to take its toll. So you're right. There are people that are happy and stable in where they are. And I think it kind of ebbs and flows, but there's always that looking backward, and that's where the stress comes from.
It strangely reminds me of a song from the Book of Mormon, Turn It Off.
Yeah.
Where they, you know, turn it off,
yep,
like a light switch, you know?
Yeah.
And it's kind of a trick that you can do for yourself to not have to grapple with something hard.
Right.
And that's how you felt. Interesting.
Yeah.
Thanks for those opening remarks. I mean, really.
Yeah.
And again, I want to tell our listeners this hour, we are not at all here to sort of just condemn one part of faith or another. It's a conversation about what doubt and what questioning and what that self-examination produces. And it's different for everybody. I mean, Anna, what has that been for you?
A few years ago, I really started to question, what does it mean? You know, what does it mean to be a Christian? What does it mean to believe that Jesus died on the cross? Why did he have to die? Why be resurrected? And I think it was really scary to take that into, to just really like hold it and try to look at all the facets. And my pastor was very kind, actually. So I go to Artisan Church, which is pastored by Scott Austin. And we met one morning, and my son was playing with the toys in the playroom, and I was just sort of sitting on the floor, like weeping, because I couldn't figure out, you know, I had been taught this like substitutionary atonement, and it was very troubling to me, you know, that you know, God can't look on us because we're so sinful, or you know, but then why? Like, why, if, you know, there's a lot of things in the Bible that I think are very hard to grapple with, which is one of the things I think Rachel did so gracefully. But he gave me this great metaphor, which was very helpful for me as I sort of tried to, like, take a look around and find out what I do really believe. And that was that, like, when you start kind of, you know, to use the deconstruction language, when you start deconstructing, it's like you're taking part of a building out, right? But you have to kind of build in some scaffolding or some supports. So you're sort of being careful about, like, what you take away and what you replace.
Otherwise, it could collapse.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I think as you're sort of taking those steps into, like, looking at what you believe, you are nervous because you've been told your whole life that the state of your soul is in jeopardy, right? And people can be worried about you because, you know, they're worried that you are literally on the path to hell. So I think to kind of do that work and take those steps into deconstruction and reconstruction, to use that language, it is scary. And I think having a community and having people like Rachel, either like the community online that she really fostered, or having an in-person community is so important, because if you're taking those steps on your own, it's just really, it's scary, and it's too scary to go on. And I think that's why a lot of people end up leaving the church.
Yeah, and on that side of fear, that either you feel internalized based on the education that you've had growing up, or maybe some of those external pressures when people are literally telling you, like, I'm worried about the state of your soul. I'll sort of out myself a little bit as saying that I don't believe in hell, but I'm sort of in the minority in that if you do believe in hell and you think that if people don't believe the way you do, they're going to hell, I sort of get why people evangelize. I get why people will say to them,
sure,
like, look here.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, you've got time here. We've got to turn this around, or you're going to this ridiculously awful place, mm-hmm, and I care about you. I'm somebody who, that actually makes sense to me, even though I don't believe it. You know, I understand why people would do that. And I've actually kind of grappled myself with this idea that people profess to be believers in hell, mm-hmm, and believers that if you don't believe the way they believe, you will go to hell. But you kind of just go through your life going, yeah, but if you don't, that's fine. Like, let's go out for coffee. We're not going to talk about it. Like, that seems like it's a pretty big thing.
Yeah.
So how do you sort of over time get to the point where what you've been taught growing up, you're willing to kind of break a little from, even as you kind of grapple with that question on, you know, do I believe in, what does an afterlife look like? What does salvation look like? Because it's strong. That stuff can be pretty heavy, right?
Yeah, yeah.
How do you get to a point where you're comfortable enough to doubt it?
I think 100% the answer is having a community who welcomes that kind of thing. Mm. In the community that I'm a part of, we have people in our congregation who are everywhere from atheists to people who were in the evangelical church. Actually, our church is a member of, like, the Evangelical Covenant Church, which is sort of walking that line of evangelicalism at the moment. And we've got, you know, people who were burned by the church. We've got people who are coming out, you know, later in life, all these kinds of things. It's a huge community. And I think what one of our foundations is really, you know, to make a safe and brave place for those people to be able to explore those things. It's never a shame, you know, no one's ever shamed for having questions or not believing or putting a question mark where others put a period. I think that's something that is really important to feel safe in a space to be able to do, because otherwise you just will kind of squelch those things down, you know, shove them down as far as they can go so that you don't have to think too hard about it, because it's just too terrifying.
Okay. Dr. Song, how has your journey sort of either mirrored or not Rachel Held Evans?
Well, I was resonating a lot with what Shani said earlier about loneliness. I think that's been something I've gone through a lot. You know, as a minority person, first-generation Asian immigrant, mixed nationality, I think finding a sense of belonging has been not always easy for me. And I think that what I appreciate about what Rachel did was that she helped create this new space for spiritual belonging where, you know, someone like myself could feel not only safe, but perhaps even thrive spiritually and theologically. So that, you know, I've really appreciated that aspect. The other thing that for me, you know, she helped create this space where you could feel passionate about Jesus and Scripture and still be pro-LGBTQI, pro-immigrant, pro-anybody who's been unjustly marginalized. And I think that that has been very helpful for me.
You know, when you talk, Dr. Song, about the importance of sort of finding that community and feeling that support, I imagine someone in your position would have a different set of risk than someone like me, you know, different backgrounds, different life experience. And so maybe the natural inclination would be to say, I'm not going to do a whole lot of self-doubt and questioning this because I at least have a community here. This is something that's comfortable, you know, and that doubt carries a little bit of, you know, social risk beyond just sort of how it feels spiritually and what it might mean. There's some social risk there, I would assume.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I think ultimately you have to be kind of true to your heart, and that's what I did. But it is definitely, especially in the culture that I came from, you know, what other people think of you or the what the social setting thinks of you is a very definitely a big factor. So, you know, I've had a lot to overcome that way.
Hmm. Pastor, when it comes to Rachel Held Evans' life, it was such a shock to hear that someone at 37, you know, tweets, you know, hey, pray for me. I'm kind of joking about missing Game of Thrones, and then days later is gone. I want to honor her at least as I would honor anybody in any sort of religious background, people who've worked hard to kind of be a public voice. But I also don't want to put too much emphasis on one person because you're hearing a lot of different stories. How many stories or how often do you hear people who are on this same kind of journey? The people in this room, Rachel Held Evans, how often are you encountering that, those sort of spiritual grappling, the questions, but also the kinds of grappling that says, I don't want to leave the faith entirely, or, you know, I don't know that this means I'm not a Christian, but what does this mean?
Yeah. I don't think enough people are presented with the possibility or the option that there is that gray area that Shani talked about.
I think that's probably right.
You know what I mean? That if you look at a traditional church, right, a Lutheran church like where I grew up on Sunday morning, every single person, and there was like 300 people in that sanctuary growing up, says the Apostles' Creed, right, after the sermon. It's part of the liturgy. To assume that every single one of those 300 people understands the exact same thing by each of the words spoken in that creed at that given time is ludicrous, because every single person's story informs the way that they define or understand or doubt or accept or struggle with or just say those words on that day because they need to say something to keep going. And that's not a bad thing. That's reality, right? That is, if you took a snapshot of reality in that moment, you would find 300 different understandings. A friend of mine who's a musician, we were talking about this the other day and talked about how, you know, you can play a C chord, but you can play infinite voicings of a C chord as much as like the instrument that you're on or the particular form of music that you play allows for, right? And none of those voicings is not a C chord, even if you're looking for a basic triad of, you know, C, E, G, right? There's so many different ways to play it. And I think in the interest sometimes of community or of not having, like Rachel said, having a dose of existential crisis with every single moment of our day, we socially agree to kind of say, this liturgical piece enables us to all be here, to gather around this statement. And that's the power, I think, of ritual and of religious language and of whether it's a particular religion or it's just a group of folks gathering together to meditate. It provides a holding space to kind of dump some of those questions and say, we're going to bracket those things and come together around this practice of being together and of giving thanks and of admitting that we've gotten it wrong and trying to find ways to get it right. So I think it's so prevalent because it exists in every single community everywhere that so many people are dumping so much stuff into this common language. And I think that's a wonderful thing. And I think also we need to also understand that people are dumping and or sharing and or bracketing so many individual experiences of what the words say, God or mother or Mary or virgin or Pontius Pilate or crucified, right? These words are, they're words. St. Augustine said, like, the words are like wine glasses, and we pour into them either the precious wine of truth or of error. So the point is, like, the words contain what we put into them. And that's not to say there's no meaning, because immediately kind of some of the more right-leaning folks will say, oh, it's relativism. It's not. It's acknowledging humanity, and it's acknowledging that in that space already gathered are so many stories, and to, rather than seeing that collection of stories and differences as a threat, to start to say, like, that's actually a much more textured and much more rich and much more engaging place to come together. So if that exists in a place where people are already accepting church or accepting kind of that language system, imagine how many more people are in that situation who won't come on a Sunday morning because they found those particular words to be traumatic or to be exclusionary or have been used in that manner. So in my opinion, I think every single human being who's ever asked why is part of this community of people wondering. And to say, like, you have to arrive at an answer right now because of some predetermined societal need for us to kind of find peace together so that we don't have to argue about things. Sometimes that's okay, and sometimes it keeps people from actually experiencing, sometimes particularly, like, religious language that might actually be a holding place for them to keep growing. So, like, I don't think every single person who doubts needs to come back to church right away, but there's a lot of people for whom having that holding space without the expectations or those alarm bells that Shani kind of mentioned might actually be good for their healing. And so if the purpose is to attain conformity, then that church is already bunk. But if the church is to create, if the purpose is to create a space where we can continue to engage and continue to grow and continue to deepen our experience of community and those things together, then I think, like, we need to remove all the barriers we can to making sure that people are welcome in that space.
Well, certainly not everyone who has this sort of experience does come back to the church. And I think this is where it gets, to me, fascinating when you look at the career of Rachel Held Evans, because I think a number of atheists would be listening to this conversation thinking, look, if you grew up evangelical, but then you started questioning and you were uncomfortable with certain aspects of it, that's the moment for you to see that all of it, you know, that's, atheists would argue, that's the moment where you see that all of it's, you know, which is not, there's so much more nuance here, that kind of what the pastor's talking about. And look at what Rachel Held Evans did in 2012. She publishes her second book, A Year of Biblical Womanhood. Every interview I've listened to with her about this did not go the way I expected. And here's why. She decided in 2011 she was going to live a calendar year biblically as a woman, reading the actual words of the Bible and then trying to live as a modern woman according to what the Bible says women are supposed to do. So she grew her hair out long. She praised her husband. She stood and held signs praising her husband in public. She deferred to him because the Bible, she felt instructed by the Bible to do so. So they would literally have debates about what to watch on Netflix, and she would say, well, we're going to have to go with what you want. And then at times she even admits it got a little weird. She, during her monthly cycle, she camped out on the front lawn in a tent because there's language in the Bible that she thought that's what she's supposed to do. She made clothing by hand instead of purchasing clothing. And at the end of this year, you know, all of these things are sort of what made the headlines. But I kind of thought she was going to end up on NPR talking to Guy Raz or whoever else she was talking to saying, but that's when I realized that the Bible, the words of the Bible, are, if you actually read it, are kind of silly. But she didn't. She said, you know, I wanted to try to experience this, but what I realized is what it means to live biblically is different for everybody. And some of that stuff is a little outlandish, but it didn't cause her to fully pivot away from it. 2 years later, she had to pivot away from evangelicalism, but she didn't leave her faith entirely. So let me ask all of our guests then, you know, for especially, this one's for the atheists listening, you know, who are listening to Rachel Held Evans and reading that book going, how did this not make you walk away entirely? Did you think about that? And was there a single issue? You know, like when Anna talks about the things that started to make her doubt, like what were those specific things? And did anything make you feel, I don't know, I don't even know if I'm a Christian anymore.
Yeah. So for me, it was, I can tell you exactly when that was. It was when I went to PA school. I went to PA school here locally at RIT, and I had a conversation with a friend of mine who was gay, and I remember talking to her about hell, and she just started crying, and she's like, I don't want to go to hell. You know, she's like, She's like, I'm a person that loves my friends. I love my mom, my family. And we were taking a philosophy of religion class, or like a philosophy class together, and we were just talking about it. And I just remember thinking, like, wow, this person is like one of my really good friends, and I really care about her a lot. And the people that I go to church with, whom don't really know me, aren't as close as I am to her. And I've gone through a lot of things personally, and she was there every time. You know, when I had a trouble and my house was broken into, this person was the first one that came to my home. You know, I am in school with her. Like, I resonate with her so much more than I do with the people that I'm supposed to be in community with and faith community with. But this is my faith. This is my person. And if she's sitting here crying and telling me how she doesn't want to go to hell, I was like, oh my gosh, like, what is it that I'm thinking here? Like, what is it that I think that, you know, what is it that I'm thinking as far as like her being better than me, as far as like racking up enough to get into the, in, like, if I do enough and say enough and rack up enough points or formula, or do it, you know, in a formula, that my formula is going to get me into heaven and her formula is not. And when I really started to actually wrote my paper about it, my paper that year, because it just, for some reason, it just really struck me, because I just couldn't reconcile that. I really couldn't. It had to, and the thing was reconciling, right? I couldn't, you know, put everything together, and it didn't make sense. Like, it literally did not make sense. So that was my thing.
But when it didn't make sense in that your faith didn't make sense to you, that this person would be excluded from sort of what you had been promised in an afterlife, or your faith didn't make sense to the point where you doubted the entire foundations of it.
So I would say both. I think the thing was, is that I'm watching this person, you know, this person that I really sincerely care about, crying because she's so afraid of hell. And this is like a deep fear that you can only see on somebody's face, right? Mm. You know, that's what I'm saying. That's what I questioned first, because I couldn't understand why a God who loves everybody and who loves me, and, you know, the Bible tells me all these things about myself that are wonderful, and this person, would cause this person to have such an internal crisis and to have such a display of emotion, because she never cried in front of me before. But that's what was coming up out of her. And that, you know, she was telling me, hey, I don't want to go to hell. You know, I don't want to go to that place. So what have I done to do that? So that was the reason for the questioning. Did it question my entire foundation? Yes. Because I had grown up in a place, that evangelical place, it was very much like us versus them and otherizing other people. And so when I saw that, I was like, well, this person's closer to me than these other folks. So, you know, what's, like, I really had to just step back and just really look at things differently.
Okay. And then when you could have scrapped the entire foundation, or at least you're starting to apparently scrap parts of it, mm-hmm. how did you either decide or feel yourself saying, I built this house, or I the community with me built this house. I'm tearing down parts of it that don't feel right, but I'm not tearing down the whole thing. Mm-hmm. I'm going to rebuild it.
So I think the thing was, for me, it was more, it was foundational, but it was also like the actual wood paneling of the house, you know, like some of that. So I couldn't actually, like, this took years, and that's what I'm saying. It's like, we're talking about deconstructionism and reconstruction, whatever you choose to do, or whatever journey you are, if you're questioning or non-questioning, you were talking about not just foundational, you were actually talking about how the house is built and what's in it, not the furniture, but the actual house itself. And so when I looked back at my house, I saw that I couldn't, you know, I couldn't keep it, and it all had to go, because especially in the political climate we were in, where other people, like, you know, I'm a Black woman, I'm a physician assistant, there's not a lot of people like me. And so for me, I definitely resonated with her and her grief and misunderstanding, because I had people misunderstanding me for what I look like, you know, and judging me for what, from where I come from or what I look like. So I had to actually, like, take out this wood paneling that said this. I had to take out another wood paneling that said that in my mind, you know, in my mind frame. And so when I looked back at the house, there was holes everywhere, and it didn't stand on its own, you know. And so that's what we're talking about. We're talking about rebuilding, you know. When we talk about, like, you know, I had people in my life that I really love and trusted from, you know, evangelicalism that I went to. I went to Bible college, and so I knew that they wouldn't accept what I was saying, but I had to say it because it was wrong. And I couldn't, like, with the non-reconciling, you know, I couldn't like I couldn't keep those relationships or maintain those relationships, which was devastating. But I also knew that, you know, when I looked at the holes and I said, this is what Rachel said, you guys, I'm trying, there's an existential crisis, because there is, you know, my house is a giant, like my house is broken. My house is on the ground. How am I going to build this? You know? And when somebody looks at you and walks away and like, well, I see that, but okay. And they walk the other way. It's like, you're just kind of left there.
I'm going to take our only break. We're going to let that kind of sit with us. And then we're going to come back and ask Anna and Dr. Song similar questions on how they kind of viewed their own paths and maybe what the issues or moments were for them that caused them to take a look at the foundation, but ultimately decide not to take the whole house down. As we talk about a journey of faith that Rachel Held Evans had and had in many ways very publicly. She passed away earlier this month, suddenly and frankly shockingly, at the age of just 37, after an illness that put her in the hospital and had young children. I mean, just really poignant and painful stuff if you read what her husband wrote about the shock of losing her. But she was an evangelical Christian who documented her journey of faith in books, in blogs, and other forms, and was very popular. You probably heard her on NPR a number of times over the years, or on PBS talking about the value of faith, but also the value of doubting and questioning. So our guests are talking about their own experiences with that. Shawnee Wilson, you just heard, Anna Voss, Dr. Sunil Song, and Pastor Matthew Martin Nikoloff from the South Wedge Mission. We'll come right back to their own thoughts on this as well next. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, let's talk about single-payer health care. We're not likely to see it at the federal level, given the current calculus in Washington, but on the state level, are Democrats who lead New York State ready to go forward with single-payer health care? What would it look like? And what do the opponents say their biggest concerns are? What do supporters say can happen if it passes on the state level only? We'll talk single-payer on Friday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Just heard Shawnee Wilson talking about her faith journey and what sort of those pivotal moments were that brought some change. Anna Voss, what about for you?
So I grew up with a gay dad. And when I first started dating my now husband, he came out to me as bisexual very soon into our relationship. And I, about a year ago, realized that I am also a queer woman. So it's been, for me, this thread of LGBTQIA plus acceptance. And I grew up in the United Methodist Church and thankfully had a youth pastor who was very gracious and kind and kind of dealing with this 14-year-old who was going like, hey, I see this stuff in the Bible or I'm hearing these things. And what does that mean? And you know, is my dad going to hell? And
you were asking directly. Huh?
Oh, yeah. and she was probably on the more progressive side for our community and was, you know, she really helped shape me as the person that I am and gave me the answer of like, well, God, you know, God creates people how they are. And if your dad's gay, that's how he was created. And, you know, so that really shaped how I've always been, you know, sort of a queer affirming, a queer adjacent person, even when I was in like a more conservative I grew up like in a smallish town outside of Philadelphia, and we mostly just didn't talk about LGBTQ issues. And you know, I had a purity ring, and I grew up in the '90s, so it was lots of purity culture and all kinds of fun stuff. you know, no sex till you're married.
Mm-hmm. Yep. True love waits.
Oh yeah, true love waits. Yeah. Yes. Oh yes. So many books.
Yep.
So many retreats. so many Bible studies.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's, I mean, I think that would be maybe one of the main threads in my life. Also, just being a woman in the church, kind of trying to reconcile those, you know, women keep your head covered and don't ever teach a man passages. And figuring out, you know, how, like, I think Rachel was very helpful in that. She has this great, I think it was a tweet from years ago that says, just because the backdrop of Scripture is patriarchy doesn't mean that the message of Scripture is patriarchy. And so I think she was really careful to look at the context, look at the culture, look at what they were working with in those biblical, you know, in the biblical era, you know, how would they have read a passage? How would they have seen this? And in the whole, like, Old Testament, actually, so my friend Judy Peterson is in town preaching at our church, and she was just talking about, like, the Old Testament, we see, you know, all this fertility language being used, and God is really speaking to his people through, you know, fertility and making sure that they're reproducing. And in the New Testament, what we're seeing is this, like, really beautiful chosen family where the early church is kind of getting together and choosing each other and taking care of each other. And so I'm really compelled by the story of Jesus and the early church. And I think even when I am in those spaces that's not willing to maybe have those conversations about queer Christians or be in those spaces that are affirming of queer people, even though they are children of God, I think it's been helpful to kind of have those people to sort of, you know, back you up, like who've done more work than maybe you were able to do or knew. Like for Rachel, it was always like she sort of knew where to start, right? Like she was a self-proclaimed Bible nerd, so she was always reading things and like would spend leisure time reading Bible commentaries, which is like not something I necessarily want to do. And she made space for people who didn't have time or didn't have the resources to do that work and kind of say, like, here's what I found, or here's the biblical context in a way that makes sense to somebody who doesn't have a seminary degree. Somebody like me who can read her work or listen to an interview and kind of understand a little bit more of where that context is coming from and really where, like, how we can understand what those biblical texts mean. So again, just kind of swinging back to the patriarchy thing, like there was like this really heavy patriarchal setup in the ancient times. And I think a lot of the teachings were meant for that time and that period. And there's a lot of things that we are taking at that we quote unquote as the modern American church are taking as like sort of prescriptive for the way that women should behave or the way that queer people should behave, or the even just the fact that like I know people who don't believe that there are queer Christians, and that's simply not true because we are everywhere. And you know, so I think to have, you know, to have somebody who's done that work and has been so helpful and has taken those, like, you know, when do you take scripture for like what it says in English, and when do you need to actually look at the language it was written in and where those words are used elsewhere.
Okay, so just to kind of make sure I understand, because as you talk about growing up as someone who found yourself, given your dad and your understanding of yourself over time, as you said, sort of queer adjacent or queer friendly and kind of in that journey, there is a history of pretty hostile approach to the LGBTQ+ community, mm-hmm. among big segments of organized religion, Christianity included. Mm-hmm. So when your friends maybe who are not friends of faith say to you, but like, look at who you are and who your family is and look at that hostility, you know, how do you square that up? Are you saying that the people who wrote some of this stuff, or at least interpreted and taught it for years, are the human side of it, but that's not actually representative of what you think the faith is or means?
I think God loves every single person. I think that everyone, all people, are welcome in the kingdom of God. I think when we talk about when Jesus, you know, when the shepherds are telling the good news of Jesus, this is good news for all people when Jesus is born. That it really means good news for all people, every single person. And I think that as a church, we have politicized and made it very easy to kind of push out the LGBTQ community. You know, when you've got somebody to blame or someone to press out because they're wrong, it's very easy to feel good about yourself and feel right. And I think, like, if you look at the history of when the word homosexuality entered the biblical translation, wasn't until 1946. So it's a lot of recent sort of layers that have demonized LGBTQ people. It's been a lot of patriarchal enforcement, I think, not to be like conspiracy theorist here, but I really do think, like, you know, when you're in power and you have power, whether it's a religion or an empire, like, you want to keep that power. And if that means subjugating, you know, a whole group of queer people, then that's pretty easy to do. And you can pretty easily do the gymnastics with the text to make it fit. But I would firmly stress that a lot of those texts are taken seriously out of context in a very harmful and weaponized way.
I'm going to turn to Dr. Sunil Song. And Dr. Song, for you, was there a moment, an incident, an issue that caused you to start reexamining?
Well, I'm not sure if there was a specific point. About 9 years ago, I married into a family that identifies as conservative evangelical, whom I continue to love and be in close relationship with. So, you know, it's been an interesting, not always easy, but an interesting journey of how to be in healthy relationship, even when you might perhaps even vehemently disagree on theology or politics. And I think Rachel actually modeled that as well in terms of how to do that. So I really appreciate the work she's done around that. I mean, I think for me personally, it's been about how to reconcile Scripture. You know, in evangelicalism, there's this concept of inerrancy where every word is literally true and you have to kind of swallow it whole. You know, I think that at some point that stopped working for me because I could not hold that belief and at the same time ignore the violence or, you know, the misogyny or other things that I just could not imitate or make that as a guide for my life. But then if that is the case, what do you go on? And I think that was a long journey. I'm kind of a nerd, so when I'm in turmoil, I start reading books. And so for a while, I was voraciously devouring book after book in theology. And I think the beauty of Scripture, as I've come to see it, is that it is actually a great mirror for the human soul. In religion and faith, we often either turn to a purity perspective where, you know, we categorize people. Some people are less holy than others because they've met the, you know, rules less perfectly. So we can take a perspective of moral purity, or we can take a perspective of justice, which is a huge tradition in the Scriptures, of treating everyone right, especially in, those who have been marginalized, the oppressed, the poor, the widow, the orphan, the refugee or immigrant. Mm-hmm. So I think that interplay, that tension between justice and purity and the decisive proclamation that the New Testament makes in saying that, you know, God is actually like Jesus in being on the side of justice, that has been really helpful for me in terms of being both serious about Scripture without necessarily having to believe in inerrancy.
Well, Pastor Nikoloff, you know, I'm thinking about something that Anna Voss said just about how she believes that the words, the texts have been sort of weaponized and twisted in certain ways so as to hurt people and preserve power for others. And I think in some ways organized religion has been weaponized in a political sphere, because some of our listeners are hearing this conversation thinking, oh, well, you know, well, Rachel Held Evans was probably just a liberal or a progressive, and sort of compartmentalizing, right? We kind of put things in these political boxes. And to some degree, I mean, Rachel Held Evans was certainly pretty proudly progressive. She talked a lot about how she could square a vote with a candidate like Hillary Clinton, who was in favor of abortion rights, even though she did not want to see abortion. She talked a lot about what it meant to help people and what the conditions were that might lead women to seek abortion. So I guess what I want to ask you is, how do we get to a point where people of faith don't feel like where they are in the faith spectrum immediately identifies their politics? Is that inextricable, or is that harmful? And are we, you know, are we maybe miles away from that, or do you think there's a path to that?
I think one of the dangers—
the pastors are going to be going like, I probably needed 24 hours to think about I'll do it on the fly.
So here's the thing, to slightly not answer your question. I think what most Christians don't realize is they want to do these kind of higher order problem solving things, like how do we elect the right leaders? How do we grow our church? How do we gain influence in the public sphere? How do we grow our, how do we get more people to follow Jesus and be more and better disciples and that kind of stuff, right? And I think what most Christian leaders don't realize is that those who are prospering do so on the back of the damage and the violence and the trauma that they have caused to the current and previous generations. And sometimes I think we mistake that maybe the real mission of the church, at least for people of privilege like myself and people in leadership positions, is less to get more people to come to our building and more to say, like, what is the fallout? What is the brownfield that we've left behind us, the contamination of trauma and damage and poison that we have sown into the soils of our community, into people's lives? And maybe it's a worthwhile life for us to spend 30, 40 years just cleaning that up, just taking care of our own mess. Stop worrying about other people. Stop worrying about how to, like, ensure that we can legislate problematic morality or feel secure or grow our church or have, like, metrics, right, that enable us to feel like we succeeded or build the addition to the church or somehow feel prosperous, to keep playing the capitalistic, consumeristic, nationalistic game. And instead say, like, maybe if I can leave this ruined field that I, even if I didn't do personally, I contributed and my tradition and my family and my descendants have, or my ancestors have helped to poison. If I can take some of the poison out of that soil so that people after me can have more freedom to choose their path, then that's actually ministry. That's actually a mission. Like, it's cleaning up our mess. And some people would say, oh, but you're not getting more money. You're not getting more numbers. You're not going to, like, get more Twitter followers doing that. And it's like, that's not the point. The point is to provide, to use the gifts and the failures that we have in the service of new creation. And so, like, maybe the best thing we can do is to stop having shows of all four pastors talking about stuff and having lay people, quote unquote, share their stories like this to start enabling.
Well, it's been a pretty powerful hour, hasn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Right? Maybe instead of, like, even one of the paradoxes I think of someone like Rachel is that it's amazing that she's such a celebrity and she gets this national attention and she goes first in these conversations that some of us are afraid to have. But I think some people get caught up in the consumer model of consuming the brand Rachel Held Evans instead of taking what Rachel Held Evans was pushing them towards, which is this kind of thing, which is in every single church, in every single neighborhood, in every single community, even in every single one of us in our interior lives, there are these conversations going on, these struggles, these wrestlings, and these deep desires for something sacred and communal. And so letting Rachel inspire us into some really scary and sometimes difficult and challenging, but also, like, really beautiful spaces where we are able to deal with some of this messiness. I think saying that here in Rochester, there are people struggling with this stuff. And if we just think, well, I listened to Rachel Held Evans once, so it's all good. Like, that doesn't solve it. But for example, our community, Shani and I know each other because we've started this thing Thursday Nights, which is essentially a place for people who have been poisoned by the brownfield and are like, I can't go back, but I don't know how to go forward. And how do I find healing? And how do I find conversation? And it's not an attempt to make you eventually come back to Jesus. It's just an attempt to say, like, you've been traumatized by something that wasn't your choice, but you don't have to let your traumatizer determine your spiritual future, because that spiritual desire you have is good. And if we can help provide some of the soil and some of the space and some of the healing you need to actually be able to be spiritual in a way that, like, connects you more closely to God and to your neighbors, then that's a mission of healing and no strings attached, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think there's a lot of work to be done that doesn't involve continuing the cycle, you know, right? Like breaking the wheel, as Rachel Held Evans would have loved to see on Game of Thrones, or maybe she would have hated seeing what happened on the show. I'm not sure, but, you know, we don't have to go there. but I think, you know, that's the key, is like leaders need to listen to the stories that are happening around them and then to start providing space for healing rather than just a space for quote unquote growth.
Got about 90 seconds left, so Shani, you're going to get the last word here.
Okay, so one thing I hope Rachel Evans's husband Dan is listening. I just wanted him to know that we so appreciated your wife. We really appreciated what she meant to us. Plowing the gray space meant so much to so many people, and I just wanted him, like, when we found out that she passed away, we were so angry, but. You know, I just wanted him to know that her death was not in vain, and she really is a stepping stone to having these conversations. So if anything, we just wanted to voice our support and say thank you so much to him for letting us have her for a short while.
I think I suspect there's going to be a lot of tributes and remarks and messages from around the country or perhaps around the world. But we'll make sure that if we can try to get the audio to him, just to I think for him to understand, as he probably already does, mm-hmm. but even more so, what this kind of legacy, what it leaves. Because she may be gone in terms of her physical presence, but it's just really interesting to have these conversations. And I hope for listeners of all different sort of backgrounds and stripes, because, you know, for me, I just wanted to kind of get in front of the mic, but then get out from behind the mic and just listen.
Yeah.
And I'm really grateful to all of you for opening up and sharing some heavy stuff. So thank you. Thanks to all of you for being here. If you tuned in late, it's because Rachel Held Evans passed away at the age of 37 on May 4th. And NPR interviewed her a number of times over the years, but they have some files where you can listen to some of what she had to say over the years. NPR repackaged it, so you can check out. And, of course, her books are out there if you want to check it out, too. Our guest this hour, you just heard Shawnee Wilson, PA for Internal Medicine at Trillium Health and co-chair of the President's Council of Diversity at Trillium Health. Thank you.
Thank you
for being here. Anna Voss, owner and artist at Owl Post Lettering. Anna, thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Dr. Sunil Song, primary care physician and chief of family medicine at Jordan Health. Dr. Song, thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Pastor Matthew Martin Nikoloff, pastor of the South Wedge Mission. Thank you, Pastor.
Thank you.
As always. Our thanks to the team behind the glass today. I'm trying to remember. Oh, I'm not allowed to mention who the volunteer is today because he's so humble. But he's great, I will tell you that much. Rob Braden is the engineer. He's also great, and I'm allowed to say his name. And, of course, you know Megan Mack. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. We'll be back with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.